For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. I'm happy to have giving the talk tonight Ben Penglaze, who's now the assistant director of Ancient Dragon Zengate and a member of our board, and is also an anthropology professor at Loyola, where I used to teach also, and has, congratulations, a new book that just came out. I'm going to read the title: Living with Insecurity in a Brazilian Favela, Urban Violence and Daily Life. Very relevant. So, Ben is going to give us a talk tonight. Thank you, Ben.
Good evening. First, I wanted to thank Taigen for this opportunity to come give a talk about my book. This is a book that I've been working on for a very long time, since I went and did research in 99 and 2000, and I've been sort of writing it and rewriting it for however many years since then. And this is the first time I've given a public talk about it since it's appeared in print, which was just 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago. So thanks for that opportunity. So what I thought I would do, and what Taigen sort of requested that I do, I talk a little bit about my book, about some of the themes in my book, and then Taigen asked that I talk about how my book connects with some of the themes of Zen Buddhism. That is the far more challenging part of this talk. This is not a book about Buddhism. It's not a book explicitly informed by Buddhism. But I think a lot of the intellectual and political questions that I try to address in this book also, for me, resonate with a lot of the teachings of Buddhism. I've been interested both in daily life in Brazil and in Buddhism since I was, oh boy, pretty young. So I guess there is quite a bit of resonance. So I'll get around to that in the second part of the talk. So what I thought I would do first is read a little bit of the introduction, explain some of it, and then read a little bit of one of the central chapters. And then I'll get around to how this connects with Buddhism, okay? So, I wanted to read just the opening part of the first chapter, and I'll explain some of it. So, the first chapter is called To Live Here, You Have to Know How to Live. One hot and drowsy day, I was sitting in Dona Carmen's backyard. Dona Carmen was one of my neighbors in Caxambu, a favela, or squatter neighborhood, in the northern part of Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Caxambu is a pseudonym for the favela, as I use pseudonyms for all the people in the book. Dona Carmen supplemented her husband's retirement pension by selling meals to people in the neighborhood. The food could be taken home on paper plates wrapped up in tinfoil, known as quinchinhas, or eaten under the shade of a mango tree in Dona Carmen's backyard, where her chickens, grandchildren, and a large pet German shepherd named Hulk, that actually was the dog's name, chased each other around in circles, creating an atmosphere of friendly chaos. I was sitting on a concrete stool next to Dona Carmen's open-air kitchen, and had just finished a plate of chicken with rice and beans, when Dona Medium, a woman from the neighborhood, came into the yard and began to talk with Dona Carmen. Dona Carmen listened to the woman's complaints, but also had one eye on the television, which was showing an evangelical Protestant talk show. Dona Medium was, as quite a few people were, an evangelical Protestant. Though I'd been living in Caxambu for several months, I had never met Dona Medium. It was clear that barely concealed underneath the flow of her complaints to Dona Carmen, her son had lost his job, her husband had lost his job, the police had recently tried to extort money from her son. Dona Medium was curious about what I was doing in the neighborhood that few wealthier people, and even fewer foreigners, ever visited. After a while, Dona Medium began to talk with me and with another couple sitting nearby. Dona Medium already knew who I was. not an unusual occurrence in a neighborhood where almost everybody knows everyone else, and where despite my ability to speak Portuguese, my wife and I stood out for our obvious foreignness, making us objects of intense local gossip from the moment we moved in, and just about every other moment after that. Dona Medium began our conversation by asking me how I liked the neighborhood. This was not a naive question, simply aimed at making pleasant conversation, and it was one that I had been asked more than once. Residents of Rio's favelas, as I show in more detail throughout this book, are highly attuned to stereotypes that outsiders have of their neighborhoods as dangerous and violent. Without quite realizing how deeply I'd internalized the opposite trope that favela residents use to counter these negative stereotypes, that favelas are actually safer and friendlier than Rio's crowded streets and anonymous middle-class apartment buildings, I answered as I often did, that I liked how friendly everyone was. Donna Medium looked at me skeptically, perhaps wondering if I really knew what I was talking about, or whether I was being honest with her. She persisted, asking, "But don't you think it's difficult to live here?" I agreed, and again dodged the issue that neither of us was openly acknowledging. Instead, I remarked upon what favela residents often hold out as the real challenges to daily lives. That sometimes the house where I lived had no water, that it was irritating that the only way to get home at night was by foot, as there was no public transportation, and taxis would never drive up the hillside on which Caxambu was built. My reference to the difficulty of entering the neighborhood at night had, as I had intended, caught her attention. Without openly saying so, I had touched upon a raw nerve. The difficulties created by exclusion of favela residents from regular urban infrastructure, such as water and sewage, why I often didn't have water, the poverty of many of the neighborhood's residents and their social and racial marginalization, were compounded by the violence that resulted from favela-based drug trafficking and corrupt policing. The drug trade, which uses favelas as stockpiling points for a citywide trade in cocaine and marijuana, creates the all-too-frequent possibility of shootouts between the police and drug dealers, especially at night as sales heat up and as many residents take to their homes. Drug trafficking also deeply influences how favelas are represented in the media, as they become depicted as fortresses for drug dealers. Dona Medium looked surprised at my answer and turned to Dona Carmen, exclaiming, "This guy comes and goes in the neighborhood at night?" "Sure," Dona Carmen replied, winking at me. "Everyone here knows him. He's friends with everyone." The young man sitting at the table nearby joined in the conversation, saying, "See, in order to live here, you have to know how to live." Now this sounds like a bit of deep wisdom, but it's actually a pop song that was part of a soap opera by Roberto Carlos, a very famous Brazilian pop singer. Anyway, Dona Medium chuckled, seemingly satisfied with this exchange, and then went on to ask me more personal questions about where I was from, how long I lived in Caxambu, and where my wife was working. So I opened my book with this little snapshot, not because it was particularly unusual, but because it illustrates a bunch of themes that I write about throughout the rest of the book. Especially how people were impacted by the perceptions that outsiders had of the type of neighborhood that they lived in, and how this often contrasted with their own perceptions of their neighborhood. So let me talk a little bit about the type of neighborhood that I lived in. Neighborhood that's called a favela, a word that's kind of become pretty common currency. I should point out that people in the neighborhood almost never used that word. They called it the morro, the hillside, instead. I want to talk about this because it's actually a rather complicated category. There's a historical origin to the word, and then a bunch of other criteria that get used. None of them, I think, completely capture the actual complexity of these neighborhoods. So, the historical origin. The first neighborhood in the city of Rio de Janeiro to be called a favela was built around the beginning of the 20th century when soldiers who had been involved in a war in Brazil's northeast came back to Rio, were demanding their back pay that they hadn't gotten yet, and they camped out on a hillside near downtown and then brought their families to live on their hillside. So that neighborhood came to be called Morro da Favela, or the hillside of Favela, after a neighborhood in northeastern Brazil where these soldiers had lived. There had, without a doubt before that, been poor people who had built homes on hillsides all around the city of Rio. There were runaway slaves who had built homes and hillsides not too far from the outskirts of Rio, going back a very long time. But this was the first neighborhood that got called Favela. And so then that word got applied to a bunch of other similar neighborhoods. Usually there are sort of four different ways of thinking about what makes a neighborhood a favela. The one that I just used in my book that I think is somewhat accurate, although not entirely, is that favelas are often described as squatter neighborhoods. This reflects part of the origins of these neighborhoods. A lot of them were built after emancipated slaves left the countryside in Rio, outside of Rio. When slavery ended in 1888, came to the city to find somewhere to live, and moved on to unoccupied hillsides. But the land tenure situation is a lot more complicated than that, so simply calling it a squatter neighborhood doesn't quite capture the complexity. The neighborhood where I lived, people first moved onto the hillside at the beginning of the 20th century. Some of them occupied land that other people claimed as their own and paid rent. Some of them occupied land that nobody had claimed before and claimed it for their own. Very quickly, there was an informal real estate market in the neighborhood where people were buying and selling land even without formal official title to it. And parts of the neighborhood, people eventually got legal title. So although they're squatter neighborhoods, this doesn't quite capture the complexity. The second most common translation for favela is slum. This captures part of what characterizes these neighborhoods in that people tend to have lower incomes than in the rest of the city, but they're also very heterogeneous in terms of income, with quite a bit of variation in terms of income. So just in the part of the neighborhood where I lived, there was a young man who was a lawyer. There were a couple women who worked in offices who made sort of fairly decent lower middle class wages, as well as people who were very poor. So it's heterogeneous in terms of income. Sometimes some people, and some Brazilian activists in fact, will use the word ghetto to describe favelas. Although I'm sympathetic with the reason why Brazilian activists use the word ghetto, I think this also doesn't quite capture the complexity of these neighborhoods. Most of the residents, although not all of the residents, are black or mixed race. However, not all. It's actually quite mixed racially. The fourth way of characterizing these neighborhoods is kind of the loosest, and therefore maybe the one that I like best. And that's that these are marginalized and excluded neighborhoods. Right? They're neighborhoods that have been actively excluded from the rest of the city, especially in terms of policing, policed in a very different way, almost from the beginning of their origins, and often excluded from a lot of basic city services. Now, as well as with these criteria, I think a lot of what residents of this neighborhood were responding to when they reacted to the term favela was really the symbolic associations that these neighborhoods carry. Living in such a neighborhood was different than living in other neighborhoods, largely because they'd been subjected to a bunch of discourses and images and media portrayals that paint them as the opposite, the other, of modern, civilized Rio de Janeiro. Now, the criteria by which they were seen as the other has shifted pretty dramatically over time. So at the beginning of the 20th century, they were seen as racially other. And it was pretty clear from a lot of media depictions they were seen, they're openly talked about as pockets of Africa in the midst of a Rio de Janeiro at the beginning of the 20th century that was the nation's capital that was trying very hard to be a modern metropolis. A little bit later, they were seen as other in terms of hygiene and disease. And so they were seen as the source of a bunch of smallpox epidemics and other epidemics that Rio was living through, subjected to very intense vaccination campaigns, social hygiene campaigns. In the 50s and 60s, perhaps not surprisingly, they were seen as politically other. There was a lot of concern about the influence and popularity of the Brazilian Communist Party, the PCdoB, in Rio de Janeiro. There were a lot of social programs, some of them sponsored by the Catholic Church, that sought to counteract this perceived influence of leftist political parties. And then they've been seen as other in terms of the space that they occupy in Rio de Janeiro's real estate. Right? Rio de Janeiro is built smushed in between the mountain and the bay and a big coastal mountain range. So a lot of these neighborhoods are on hillsides near or adjacent to much wealthier neighborhoods. Not the one where I was living, where I lived. So in the 70s, a lot of them were torn down and people were pushed out to other parts of the city. Now in the 1980s, they come to be seen as other because of the influence of drug trafficking. To make a complicated story short, in the 1970s, late 1970s, early 1980s, there's a big region-wide boom in cocaine trafficking. There are a bunch of reasons why this happens. One of them is a shift in demand from drugs from the United States. This goes along with shifting patterns of repression. The U.S. encourages the Mexican government to aerially fumigate a bunch of marijuana plantations in Mexico. This leads some people to shift to cocaine consumption. Colombian traffickers step in and start producing first marijuana and then move into cocaine in a big way. As patterns of repression shift again and the U.S. cracks down on the Caribbean trade routes, Brazil becomes one of the routes for cocaine transshipments from Colombia, where it's processed into powder cocaine, through Brazil to Europe and to the United States. And there's a big local consumption of cocaine among wealthier people. So what you see emerging in the 80s, and what was still rather characteristic of how these neighborhoods were described when I lived there, was the sense that they were these fortresses of criminality and drug trafficking. So let me read you, if I can find it. Okay. So, in the 1980s, there is a criminal organization in the city of Rio de Janeiro that calls itself the Comando Vermelho, the Red Command. It organized itself in the prison system in Rio de Janeiro. A lot of the first people who were involved in the Red Commands were bank robbers and car thieves. They're consolidating their power in the prison system at the time that drug trafficking is taking off in the city of Rio de Janeiro. They consolidate their hold within the prison system by staging a couple of violent attacks on prison guards and other gang members, and then rapidly escape from prison and move into controlling drug trafficking in the city of Rio. This inaugurates what a lot of people talk about as a period of war and warfare between the police and this drug trafficking organization, the Comando Vermelho. The Comando Vermelho does one very important thing as it moves into controlling the drug trade in the city of Rio de Janeiro. It realizes that favela neighborhoods can be really useful stockpiling points for citywide trade in cocaine and marijuana. Because a lot of these neighborhoods, because of how they grew, are located on transportation routes, as poor people sought to live near train lines and bus lines and freeways. Or they're located near wealthier neighborhoods, because a lot of poor people live near wealthy neighborhoods where they worked as maids in the service industry. These neighborhoods were also characterized by a lot of animosity between residents and the police. So residents distrusted the police. The police did not patrol these neighborhoods on a regular basis and provide any kind of security. So this drug trafficking organization, the Comando Vermelho, realizes that it can take advantage of this. of the strategic location and of this relationship between favela residents and the state. And it implements a policy that it calls a policy of boa vizinhança, good neighborliness, in which it makes a bargain with residents of poor neighborhoods. And the bargain goes something like this. As long as you let us come into your neighborhood and run our business and turn a blind eye to it, we will provide safety in the neighborhood. A lot of what I explore is the paradoxes of this bargain, right? But so from this period, there are a bunch of images of these neighborhoods as neighborhoods at war. And it's this war metaphor that really has an important effect on people's lives. So let me read a little bit about the war metaphor. In recent decades, the city of Rio de Janeiro has been described as experiencing a unique and drastic form of urban warfare. A war, paradoxically, that is not a war, or perhaps an undeclared civil war. For example, in a documentary film, a police captain assigned to a special elite battalion stated the following. On April 20th, I arrived at police headquarters before sunrise, and I was standing on the veranda, looking at the morros, the hillside, the favelas. I noticed that there were tracer bullets flying from one hillside to the other. It was a war between drug dealers, and they were using tracer bullets, right? And then I thought to myself, in what other city of the world that is not at war would you see such a scene? Because there's no civil war in Rio de Janeiro. What we're living through is a war in the hills, a war between policemen and traffickers, or between traffickers themselves. Right? So a lot of what I try to explore is the effects of both conflict between traffickers and the police and among traffickers, and this set of images of favelas, and people's experience of these neighborhoods. Their experience of these neighborhoods is shaped by a long history of folks living together in these neighborhoods. As I mentioned, people first moved into the hillside at the beginning of the 20th century. They often then had extended family members come and live with them. People would rather frequently occupy a big lot, build a home for their children on the lot behind them. Their grandchildren would then build a second story. In some cases, their great-great-grandchildren will build a third story. So this was a neighborhood that was at the same time marked by racism, by exclusion because of how they were perceived as backwards and a threat to the city. And yet at the same time, one marked by a lot of social familiarity, places where people all knew each other, or places where people all interacted with each other. A place that, in a way, was seen as safer and more familiar. Both because the drug traffickers provided a certain sort of safety, although I'll get to that in a second, but also because it was a neighborhood where people didn't have to suffer the same kind of prejudice that they faced in the rest of the city because of their skin color and assumptions of about where they lived. So the rest of the book is an attempt to explore these paradoxes. What is it like to live in a neighborhood that is, on the one hand, familiar, an object of pride, a neighborhood that people have literally built themselves over generations, yet at the same time a neighborhood that is a site of exclusion and a site of danger. I also explore what is it like for people in the neighborhood to live with their neighbors, in some cases their relatives, who are involved in the drug trade. So I look at the first paradox of the neighborhood as a place of familiar danger. And the second one, how do people deal with dangerous intimates, people who they know who for one reason or another have been involved in the drug trade? I can talk a lot more about why young men do that in a little bit. But let me read you another little segment because I'm running out of time. So this is a section of another chapter in the book called A Familiar Hillside and Dangerous Intimates, where I look at these two sort of interlocking paradoxes. An incident from my field work reveals how the language of familiarity, the way in which people would talk about the hillside as an extended family, influenced daily social life and also shows the complexity and contradictions of living in a familiar place. It highlights how drug trafficking and urban violence shape notions of a familiar place, producing a particularly sharp challenge to adult men who did not participate in drug dealing. One afternoon, shortly before I'd moved to Caxambu, I was invited to a Sunday afternoon churrasco, a barbecue, at the home of Seo Lazaro, the head of the local residents association. When I arrived at his house, Seo Lazaro's daughter, Sonia, let me in the front gate. Seo Lazaro was sitting on a metal folding chair on his concrete patio under the shade of a mango tree, drinking beer, and invited me to sit down with him. A short while later, a drug dealer named Tubarão, Tubarão means big shark, that's not his real name, but he had an equally awesomely sinister real nickname. Anyway, Tubarão came in through Seo Lazaro's front gate. Tubarão was a wiry black man in his 20s with a clean-shaven head and a twisted, broken-tooth sneer, and always wore mirrored sunglasses. His sinister appearance and his eagerness to use violence accounted for his nickname, Big Shark. His real nickname was Formigone, Big Ant. I think because, like, the classes, I don't know. Anyway. Tubarão was respected and feared. He was also often high on cocaine, making him even more erratic. So Lazaro had a large cooler that he kept stocked with beer to sell on hot weekend afternoons, like a lot of people he was involved in a bunch of informal economic activities. Tubarão sat down next to me and asked if Seo Lazaro had any cold beer to sell. It was a particularly hot day, and Tubarão wasn't wearing a shirt. Strapped to his chest, which was rather common for people to not wear shirts, the neighborhood space gets treated almost as sort of an extension of domestic space. Strapped to his bare chest was a leather holster that prominently displayed a .45 caliber revolver. So Lazaro looked over at Tubarão and said, "Sure, but come with me." They walked over near the gate and exchanged a few words, and Tubarão stepped outside. A few minutes later, Tubarão returned. He draped a white t-shirt over the revolver. He had just put a white t-shirt. He hadn't put a t-shirt on. He had just put it over the gun that was on a holster. It was obvious that the gun was still there. We chatted a bit about a Mike Tyson boxing match that was going to be shown on television later that evening. After a few minutes, Danilo, Seo Lazaro's nephew, came by with two bottles of Skol beer. Tubarão took them and walked out of the gate. "You know," Seo Lazaro told me, "I saw that kid grow up. I knew him when he was a little kid, in diapers." So a lot of what I explore is this paradox, right, that's generated also by young men who get involved with the drug trade, who are on the one hand socially familiar to people in the neighborhood. They're their school friends, their neighbors, their cousins, their nephews, their sons and daughters and grandchildren. On the other hand, when they get involved in the drug trade, they're seen and talked about as other and different. And people are aware that they often bring a lot of violence to the neighborhood. So I like this vignette because it explores some of these paradoxes. So Lazaro was able to tell Tubarão to hide his gun, and yet Tubarão only ironically hid his gun. It showed how Seo Lazaro had enough familiarity with Tubarão to have some influence on him, and yet also how the drug trafficking world was destabilizing local social norms as a much older man, Seo Lazaro, who should have commanded a lot of authority and respect over Tubarão, was no longer able to do that. Right? How does this connect to Buddhism? I think it connects to Buddhism in two ways. The first and probably most straightforward one is that it connects to the first noble truth, the existence of suffering. A lot of what I try to do in my book is to show the multiple different forms of suffering that impact people's lives, both the visible forms of suffering, drug trafficking, police violence, but also a lot of the sort of hidden, less visible structural forms, and how these overlap. And so I look at media images and discourses about favelas and how those also impact people's daily lives. We could think of this as looking at how greed, hatred, and delusion produce some very deep structures which shape people's daily lives. Of course, this is very familiar to us as students of Buddhism. The second way in which it connects is that a lot of what I was doing in my book was exploring categories and how they break down and fall apart and become fuzzy as people try to understand a complex and shifting reality. I explore quite a bit the categories of safety and danger, security and insecurity. How does the neighborhood rapidly shift from a place that people perceive as safe to one that they perceive as dangerous? But also, what are the gray areas, the zones where those distinctions start falling apart? I think we as Westerners are often particularly caught up in this either-or kind of logic, right? Either it's an A or it's a B, either it's safe or it's dangerous. What I found in the neighborhood where I lived, and I think that it has to do with some sort of deep structures in Brazil, is that the boundaries between categories were often blurred. And people often operated not on an either-or logic, but on a both-and logic. So the neighborhood was often seen as both safe and dangerous. People in the neighborhood, young men who participated in drug dealing, were seen both as a source of protection, a source of assistance, and as a source of potential danger. And these categories of safe or dangerous were also often very fuzzy. This obviously connects with a deep theme in Buddhism. We could look at this either-or logic and see it reflected in Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna, the Indian philosopher, the founder of the Madhyamaka branch of Mahayana. I will probably massacre Nagarjuna's negation because it always gives me a headache, which I think is sort of the point, right? So Nagarjuna would say it's not either or, it's not A or B, it's not safe or dangerous, it's not safe and not dangerous, and not safe and dangerous, and not neither safe nor dangerous. I think I got it, right? The pitfalls and problems and contradictions and inadequacies of this kind of categorical thinking are also, of course, explored quite a bit in Buddhism, in the form of Buddhism that we practice here, right? Where I think they tend to be explored less through Nagarjuna's kind of logic, but more poetically and more viscerally, right? So in our Zazen practice, we often have those moments where we can feel in a visceral way that some of those categories are only a partial and incomplete way of understanding the world. Often I have that sensation as I watch my mind going over and over again the same patterns, realizing that those patterns are themselves only partial. And it's also, of course, explored in a very poetic way. So I asked Taigen to have us chant the Song of the Grass Hut, because the neighborhood that I lived in, nobody lived in grass huts anymore. They lived in brick huts. There was one person who still lived in a mud and wattle home, so like homemade bricks. He was really famous as being a curer in the neighborhood, knew a lot about herbal medicine. So everyone lives in brick homes, pretty much, some wooden homes. But they are very much homes that are in various stages of falling apart and being rebuilt over and over again continuously. I also had Taigen read this because there are a bunch of passages in this that really strike me as indicating the sort of problems and drawbacks of categorical thinking. For instance, the person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. And a lot of what I explore in my book was exactly this. In this case, in a lot of ways, the people who lived in this neighborhood had no choice but to deal with some of the paradoxes that were imposed upon them. And what I really tried to look at was how did they navigate inside and outside and in between? How did they come up with ways of living within, inhabiting these paradoxes that had such a big impact on their life? So maybe I'll leave it there and see if you have questions or comments. I probably went a little bit over time.
Yes?
That was great. I really enjoyed that. Suzuki Roshi talks about things being not one, not two. It makes the same point. It's so much simpler than Nagarjuna.
Yeah.
the question I wanted to ask you was a little unclear to me. So I mean, it has to do with your ethnographic work.
Sure.
First off, there are two parts. First off is I wasn't sure whether the drug folks, were they pretty much, like within your particular favela, were those people pretty much from that favela?
Yeah.
Or was there a lot of, so does this conflict wind up being between different favelas, or is it sort of intra-favela?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, it's both, of course, right? When in the early 80s, when this drug trafficking organization, the Comando Vermelho, organized criminal organization, moved into drug trafficking, a lot of the guys in that organization went to neighborhoods where they were from, and they used the connections that they had, the citywide connections, to set up distribution of cocaine into the city, and to set up a network of power and force. So they had access to guns, they had access to soldiers, to young men willing to fight for them, that allowed them to take over the drug trade. So it was largely local people in the neighborhood, local young men, a few women, who were involved in the drug trade.
Control from outside, or?
Yes, so the drug dealers in my neighborhood stockpiled and bagged, processed cocaine and marijuana. Then they had a chain of dealers who sold it to people who would either come into the neighborhood to buy it, or there were dealers who would take shipments on consignment and sell them in the neighborhood outside of the city, right? And so this was the retail end of part of the citywide drug trade, right? There's a larger network of more influential and powerful people who were involved in bringing shipments in and out of the city. That's where all the money is made. Not that much is made on the street level. So there's conflict both between, now there are three or four different gangs who fight over who controls which drug selling and distribution territories. The neighborhood where I lived, was part of the Comando Vermelho. The guy who was in charge of drug dealing was allied with a much more powerful drug dealer in a neighborhood that did a lot more business in the drug trade. So he had a good alliance. But there were other drug gangs that would come and try to take over neighborhoods. They often did that by exploiting internal rivalries. Mm-hmm. So there was also internal rivalries over who occupies positions of influence within the drug trade. Rival gangs would try to use those internal rivalries to take over neighborhoods. The police would exploit those internal rivalries pretty dramatically.
The second part of my question, or second question,
yeah,
just had to do, so much of what you described in a very general way sounds so much like what I've heard, yeah, people describe certain sort of neighborhoods here.
Sure.
In particular, Fort Greene.
Sure.
Was torn down.
Yep.
You know, people used to talk about that. You know, it's home, it's safety, it's like, you know, it's protection of the police. I just wanted to know that.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I think in some broad strokes, it's similar to a lot of excluded and criminalized neighborhoods where people have this very ambivalent relationship to all sorts of informal economies. That are at the margins of legality, where on the one hand they rely upon them to survive, there's certain resources they extract from them, and at the same time they often understand the cost, the longer term cost that comes from that. They're neighborhoods that are on the one hand products of patterns of exclusion, so that people cannot afford to live in other parts of the city. That neighborhood where I lived, it was really clear. You know, part of why generations of people had lived there is because they couldn't afford real estate in another part of the city. And at the same time, exactly because of that, like because of their exclusion, there are also these tight-knit places, mm-hmm, where you have generations of people who've grown up knowing each other, interacting with each other, dealing with each other. Right? And so again, it's that not one, not two. That I didn't get to say it. My little mantra as I was writing this book, there's a very famous Brazilian journalist at the turn of the 20th century who was kind of this dandy who's probably gay, journalist who wrote these kind of observations of daily life. We don't really have in American newspapers, called crónicas. They're very common in Latin American newspapers. Anyway, his name was João do Rio, and he said famously that Brazil's motto shouldn't be order and progress, which is the motto on the Brazilian flag, order and progress. It should be the order in the disorder. And so what I kept trying to, you know, where's the order in the disorder, and where's the disorder in the order, right? And you know, how do those two, how do we see them not as opposites, but as things that inherently go together?
Yeah, Bill.
Thank you for this, and congratulations on your book.
Yes.
I had two questions also. And the first one's more directly political, and the second one is more Buddhist, shall we say.
Yeah.
So in Mexico, for example, the Mexican state, government, police, etc., the whole society, I mean, it really has no interest whatsoever. I mean, material interest in curtailing the drug trade, because it's a very significant source of income for Mexican society, and some of that income even gets reinvested in so-called legitimate enterprises and whatnot. And I wonder what the status of that sort of thing was in Brazil. And going along with that, I also wonder, where are the police really in this? Are they, in effect, another gang, their own gang? Or are they actually doing something about the drug situation, you know, that's in any way constructive?
Yeah. No, that's a really good question. It's broadly similar. I think that the Brazilian state profits from drug trafficking in a number of different ways, right? It's clear that there are influential people in the Brazilian economy and Brazilian politics who are receiving kickbacks in one way or another. And it's clear that the Brazilian police force receives all sorts of resources and weaponry that it wouldn't receive otherwise. It's clear that there's a whole industry that's been built around perceptions of security and insecurity. At the same time, and it's also clear that the drug business grows out of an older pattern of relationships between economic and political elites and people who live in poor neighborhoods, right? These patron-client networks, the drug traffickers can move in and kind of appropriate and take over, right? So I have a real problem, and I know you're not saying this, with this idea that the state is absent. People talk about the Mexican state as a failed state, and people say the same thing about neighborhoods in Rio, that, well, the state was never there, and therefore drug traffickers moved in. I think it's much more complicated, sort of perverse symbiosis, right? Now, I think what happened in Rio de Janeiro is that the drug trade created a lot of chaos and disruption for the rest of the city. I think it became sort of unmanageable for the rest of the city, and the political authorities shifted their policing strategy pretty seriously, right? So in the 80s and 90s, parts of the police were involved in extorting money from drug dealers. Parts of the police were clearly involved in selling weapons to drug dealers. Parts of the police were playing one gang off another gang. Other parts of the police were getting their bonuses and their raises from being involved in violent shootouts with drug dealers. And so they would show up, and they did this in the neighborhood I lived in twice, shoot someone and then say it was a shootout, and then they would get promotions and raises. So it's not kind of direct corruption, but it's another way of manipulating insecurity in order to profit from it, right? What happened starting around 2006 is that the perception of Rio as unmanageable and unsafe started hurting a lot of the economic interests in the city. It started having a big impact on foreign investment, on tourism. The political and economic elite want to make Rio the hub of Brazil's new growing oil industry, right? And so they systematically changed policing strategies. They sent new police officers into favela neighborhoods, police officers who hadn't had these prior patterns of corruption. They have a now permanent police presence in a lot of the neighborhoods. That's not to say that drug dealing has stopped. It's hidden. That's not to say that corrupt relationships between drug dealers and the police have gone away. They're just under the table. That's not to say that violence between the police and drug traffickers, or between the police and residents of poor neighborhoods, has stopped. It's just a little bit less dramatic than it was when I was there in the late 90s and beginning 2000s, when it was really kind of at a pretty intense pitch. So.
You had a second question, Bill?
Yeah,
there's time for one more.
So it would take a long answer. I know it's in a way a very simple question in there, but I think it's in Chinese Buddhism that this doctrine of the two truths mm-hmm. sort of arose, and I wondered if...
No, it goes back to India, but yeah, yeah.
Something like the two insecurities that in a way are the mirror of that, where one is the practical everyday and the other is on kind of ontological plane.
Yeah, without a doubt. And people would often... People would voice it often through religious metaphors and would often talk about, look, you know, I try to figure out what's a safe time of day to walk around the neighborhood, what isn't, who can I trust and who can't I, is the guy on the corner with a gun going to help me out or not? But then they would often shift into this other register and they would say, ultimately, you know, it's, oh, can I read a final? Oh, because it's just so perfect for this. Yeah. So, this was the end of the chapter that I was reading about. To put on the big shirt. In attempting to deal with the state of insecurity, in quotations, so security and insecurity, the residents of the mole who often turn to a metaphysical realm. Here, if they could not actively control what was happening in their lives, they could at least construct a place where things do not happen merely for random and unpredictable reasons. This aspect of daily life in Kashubu was brought home to me one afternoon as I ate lunch in Donna Carmen's backyard, the woman who I started the first vignette with. Donna Carmen was watching television, commenting freely on the show. It was a talk show featuring an evangelical Protestant minister and various guests who claimed to have had miraculous cures after prayer sessions. One man, though, called in to complain that despite going to church every day, his health continued to deteriorate. See, he doesn't believe, Donna Carmen told me with disdain. He's doubting the power of Jesus, and he'll always live in fear. He wants Jesus to help, but he doesn't really believe. Because, you know, our fate is in God's hands. Only he knows our path. Any minute you might die. You have to have the faith to deal with that so that you'll take the right path. If at the hour of your death you haven't accepted this, it's too late. Because no one understands life. A few days ago, Claudio came to see me. Did you know Claudio? Probably not, because he'd been in prison for a long time. Well, he'd just gotten out of prison and he came to see his family and his child. He came to talk to me, to ask me and my husband for our blessing, and ask me to make him some lunch. We talked for a long time, then he paid for the lunch and walked out of the gate, just like that. He just walked out. The next day we heard that he'd been found, that they'd found his body down below at the entrance to the neighborhood. They stuck a tire over him and set him on fire. He had a bunch of debts to the drug dealers. You see, you never know. There he was one day, talking to me and happy to see his child and be out of prison. The next day he was dead. Yeah, I mean, so as people use this categorical thinking, I think they're also very much aware of the fact that it can't explain everything.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Ben. We could obviously go on for a long time, but it's getting later. I just wanted to add the whole issue of what is security, what is insecurity, that you're, you know, presenting this very specific instance of is something that's very deep for all of us, and how, where do we find something to take refuge in, and at the same time, how do we live in the context of the insecurity and then all the political ramifications for us too in terms of the security state, and anyway. So, a lot to think about, and we can continue talking about it informally, but we'll close now with the four Bodhisattva vows.
Beings are numberless. soul, I bow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I bow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I bow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I bow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I bow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I bow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.